welcome to the Friday Filibuster. I am not, as you may have guessed, Dave Johnson. Instead, I am Michael Staley, sitting in for the vacationing Dave. But everything else about the show pretty much remains the same. Joining me is Judge Eric Asperschlager.
Hello.
And Mac McIntyre.
I could do.
All right, so I guess the big thing that we can start out with, and Dave wanted me to make sure that we had a discussion here, but Eric suggested we do a real rear spoiler section as well, but The Dark Knight Rises has been unleashed.
And it has. I think that we're – each of us represent a different point in the timeline of seeing it.
This is true.
Right, because you saw it opening night at the end of the, you know, the trilogy marathon.
Right.
Wow. Saw it a couple of days later, and Mac, you like almost literally just got home.
Yeah, I got home about 30 minutes ago just from seeing it, so I'm in gut reaction mode.
All right, well, let's start with the most visceral reaction. Mac, what do you think?
It's hard to know what to think. It's like information overload.
It is.
The movie is just, it's dense. It's packed with just so much plot. There's so many characters, and each character has his or her own storyline to follow. And the various storylines, you know, intersect at different parts of the movie, and it's just so much to follow, and it's so much to just take in and absorb. I'm just kind of blown away by it all.
Do you watch the other two movies before having gone to see this?
That was the plan, but I ended up not doing that.
Okay.
I don't know if that helped or hurt or not, but I had, of course, seen them several times. I just hadn't, not recently.
Sure. There were a surprising number of clips that Chris used in this film.
Yeah, callbacks and stuff to help get people caught up to speed.
Yeah. All right, Eric, your thoughts?
I have to say, the further I get from having seen it, the less excited I am about it. And I know that I had had sort of a similar reaction when I saw Dark Knight the first time. I wasn't super crazy about it. The more times I've seen it, the more I've liked it. Part of the problem when I saw Dark Knight, I talked about it a million times, is that the audio was terrible, which ruins the movie. Because I think that, you know, Christopher Nolan movies especially are these, like Max said, these dense, layered, kind of intricately plotted, you know, stories. And if you miss just one piece, it can all fall apart. I have to say that this latest movie felt a lot less tightly constructed than pretty much any of his other movies. I have to say this is probably, I think, the messiest of his movies in general, and kind of disappointing. And I know we're – so we are going to talk at the end, more spoilery?
Yes. Yes,
okay. I'll keep it general now. I think that there are some – it's kind of some basic problems with the movie that keep it from being as good as the other two, or really I think as good as most of his other – movies. So we can talk more about that later, I guess. Yep.
And since you brought up the audio, can we, I think Chris Nolan movies are going to start to need subtitles because,
absolutely.
Because there were a lot of moments where Bane or Batman were talking where I'm like, I didn't understand what he just said.
There's a lot of those other characters. Marion Cotillard is hard to understand in places. Sure. It's like he writes these scripts where you have to hear every word and then hires actors who are incapable of speaking every word clearly. Now, did you guys notice that in the movie Bane's dialogue is ramped up compared to everyone else's, or was that just in my screening?
That was definitely mine, yeah. They really pushed the sound of his voice a lot to make so that it would really have an impact.
No, I remember hearing before the release that Chris actually went back and adjusted Tom's dialogue based on criticisms from the press screenings or, you know, studio screenings.
In the trailer.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's a bit of a frustrating contrivance to begin with that you're going to have this man talk into basically a muzzle and expect him to be heard clearly, especially when he's trying to do a Sean Connery impersonation.
Right.
I don't know. For whatever reason, watching the three movies together, Christian Bale did not have that voice in the first film. It showed up in the second film, and now it's extremely irritating in the third film, and I don't understand the choice.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about Kevin Conroy's performance on Batman the Animated Series, which is this rich, lush, powerful voice, and then you turn around and you have him like he's got throat cancer. That makes it really difficult to understand. And I just don't understand the character choice from that perspective.
It's weird because I just finished reading the first part of Nightfall before I watched the movie, and there is actually a line in that book, I think, when Jean-Paul is taking over for Batman, where Robin says something about Bruce's gravelly voice when he's Batman. And I don't know if it was that one throwaway line kind of informed part of that, or if that's part of the Batman character that I just, you know, don't know about because you're reading words on a page. Mac, you might know more.
Yeah, if I were to speculate, I'd just say that's their excuse of, you know, how come people can't tell it's Bruce Wayne if he's not covering his mouth, and oh, he talks differently when he's Batman. That would be my speculation, but that and just the old, the idea that, you know, he uses theatrics to scare criminals, so, you know, he's going to, you know, tweak his voice just so that he's really dark and gloomy and scary.
Yeah. I think that's sort of true of all these movies, that there are choices that are made that can be justified if you want to say, well, they were probably trying to do this, you know, it, or even things that are explained in the movie, but that's just kind of taken in the context of why you're making this choice in a movie are less defensible. Do you know what I mean?
It's because they take it so far.
Yeah, or just things that if you were to bring up certain nitpicks with, you know, super fans, they would say, well, this is why it's this. They said it in the movie, but they don't necessarily make sense as choices in a movie. They don't help the movie in any way.
Now, did the fact that the Colorado tragedy happened impact your viewing the film?
A little bit. There's a scene early on where Bane and all of his thugs, they attack a really crowded place. And that their machine guns are going off and stuff. And I was watching that going, oh my.
There are definitely scenes in that movie of people bursting into crowded places and shooting people that kind of play very differently now. And it's not the movie's fault at all, you know, but it is an unfortunate, I mean, the whole thing is a tragedy. It's terrible, terrible. But I mean, it's definitely kind of on your mind when you're watching it, especially now.
And in the lobby of the theater where I saw it, there was a bunch of rent-a-cops.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Checking people out before they walked in.
See, and it's so different for me, having been isolated from that whole thing and not finding out about it until the next day.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to go back and see it again. Now, did either of you guys see it in IMAX?
No, I saw it just at the multiplex. Okay. It was a nice multiplex with a big screen and real nice sound, but not IMAX.
Yeah, that'll be interesting, too. I'm curious. We have the IMAX screen right here, but as part of the marathon, it was only shown on the standard screen. So I'll be curious to go back and see it again in the IMAX experience.
Right. And that's certainly a reason to go back and see it, you know, to get just to see that very tangible difference between small screen and the giant screen.
Right.
And I've noticed, I mean, this is not new to me, but it seems like Christopher Nolan movies are movies that have to be watched more than once.
Well, and it's interesting you say that, because you had brought up the fact of how your opinions changed of other things, and sitting there watching these three movies in a row, my opinion has changed, and it has changed several different times, like you said, throughout seeing this. And it's curious, because I can't think of another filmmaker, save for maybe Hitchcock, who has had that effect on me.
I'm still trying to figure out whether it's a good thing that you need to see his movies more than once.
Yeah.
I mean, it sort of seems like if you're going to make a movie, and there are a lot of directors who do it now, it sort of is this trend where blockbusters are so overstuffed and packed with things that it just kind of is too full for the space of an actual movie on a movie screen. And I think that is it's a problem. You're making a movie fit within the constructs of that movie. Be big, be brash, be epic, but, you know, maybe dial it back a little bit so that we can get it within the medium. But
right, with this film in particular, I mean, it's just so much. They threw everything they had at the wall, and it almost requires a second viewing just to pick up on everything you missed the first time.
Yeah. I'm counting that.
Sorry, it moves so fast, just plot point to plot point to plot point. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. It's almost relentless.
Yeah, I'm actually at the moment I'm putting that in the negative column. I don't think that's a good thing about the movie.
Maybe we should discuss it. We're being awfully negative here. What was some good stuff about the movie? What do we like about it?
I mean, I think it's full of great moments. I mean, while I was watching it, there were just scenes that were completely thrilling. The giant action, and I know Michael, you said this, I think even on Entertainment Docket, that the ending, it really builds to kind of a spectacular finish.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are things looking back on it now in the ending that I'm not crazy about, but just the experience of watching it all unfold and come together was just really thrilling. Yeah.
I was really impressed with Anne Hathaway. She really surprised me with how good she was in the movie.
Well, and you know, Mac, I love that he nailed the Bruce and Selena relationship because it's so important to the mythology, and it's been so satisfying to see that kind of transcend all the different genres. Julie Newmar and Adam West had it in the original 66 series in a very comic way. It really played out exceptionally well in the animated series. Well, the Michael Keaton, Michelle Pfeiffer thing in Batman Returns, and to actually have it here in kind of a precursor romantic tease role, I really liked what they did with it.
So that was definitely a hype. I wasn't expecting much from her, and she really surprised me.
Yeah. What else? It definitely scratches a lot of comic fan itches.
Oh yeah.
Which, you know, pluses and negatives. But I mean, you're watching it and being able to say, "Oh, that's this and that's that," and "Oh, I love how they did this and they took that from the comic books," and "Oh, they brought that character in," is a lot of fun.
So yeah. You're right. It does work on a number of different levels. If you're going to see a big blockbuster, you've got that. If you're going to see kind of a gritty crime drama, you've got that. If you're a Batman fan, there's that's satisfying for you too. So it's a rare director who can make all those things happen and reasonably well. I mean, granted, there are pitfalls, but for the most part, he's pulled it off better than anybody else has. Now, did you see the trailer for Superman? Man of Steel prior to the film?
Yeah, I did.
And your thoughts?
I'm not really liking it.
Thank you. Thank you. Eric?
He's a fisherman. He's on a boat. And when he flies, see those streaks of smoke coming from under his cape? It doesn't work for me. Oh, and then did they show the S, the Superman symbol, and it's got all these extra swirls on it? For, like, no reason? I don't know.
I didn't see actually our small theater here in town didn't show any trailers before the movie. Oh, wow. Which started right up. It's actually one of the nice things about going there. But yeah, I saw it online. I don't know. It was a teaser, so you can't get much from it.
Right.
I'm not hopeful in the same way that I'm not hopeful about any current comic book movie that isn't Ant-Man, but love that guy, right? But yeah, I don't know. If they're doing something different, at least they're trying something different. Maybe it's going to be terrible. Zack Snyder is hit or miss, but maybe he'll hit. So I guess we'll see.
Well, and I don't think I have a lot of faith in that the Bryan Singer film I did not like at all.
Yeah.
And I know there are people who do enjoy it, and I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but it did not work for me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm on record saying I liked the Bryan Singer film, but a lot of that was contingent on, okay, let's see where he's going with this in part two. And then part two never happened.
Yeah.
So that it's just kind of floundering now.
So if this is their next franchise, they've got a hell of a hill to climb to prove themselves with this before moving into the Justice League thing, which is rumored that they're going to try and emulate the whole Marvel phenomenon. So we will see how successful they'll be at that.
Interesting if they'll be able to pull it off.
I know. It's going to be tough because they're going to have to come up with a Wonder Woman movie. And, well, I mean, the Green Lantern movie obviously didn't do so well, so they've got a couple strikes against it already. All right, if that's what we've been seeing, how about what we've been reviewing for the site, Eric?
I got a couple of movies this week. The first one is it's called Detention. It's directed and co-written by Joseph Kahn, and it is a little hard to describe. It is essentially a teen horror comedy sci-fi romance time travel movie. it's a very kind of forward looking, frantically paced, referential movie that I know some people have sort of described as being a little bit like Scott Pilgrim, but not so much in content as much as kind of the way that the Kahn directs the movie, which is very kind of speaks to the way modern teens and youth, and I suppose even people of our age, consume media, which is very quickly. It's very, like I said, referential. There's a lot of like 90s references. The characters go into a lot of strange places, and it's all kind of it's both a commentary and being the thing that it's aping. It's a very strange movie. I have to watch it again to kind of wrap my mind around it. Generally, I liked it. I think it's worth checking out because it's so odd. The kind of basic plot is that it's kind of end of school at this Grizzly Lake High, and there's this serial killer who's emulating a popular movie who's killing people. But at the same time, there's a girl who's not all that popular who's trying to get the attention of a boy who's trying to get the attention of this popular girl. I mean, it borrows a lot from a lot of different genres and movies. At the same time, it's making fun of them and appropriating it. I still have to figure out what I think about it, but it's worth checking out. And then a very different kind of movie, a music documentary called Big Easy Express, which follows a kind of a train tour of the United States by the bands Mumford & Sons, Old Crow Medicine Band, and Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros. And it's, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's if you like their music, which is, I don't know, kind of folksy bluegrass type of music, and you'll enjoy it. There's a lot of music. Apparently, they just played nonstop. There's tons of them just jamming on the train and in fields, and they just, you know, they're great musicians and very energetic and a lot of fun. So, I think there is definitely an audience who will like that.
Nice, Mac.
Views on the site right now. It's the movie Lockout, Guy Pearce.
Yes.
It's a really cheesy B movie about a prison break, except that the prison is in outer space, and the president's daughter happens to be aboard when the prison break happens, and only Guy Pearce can rescue her. thing is, you know, it's. I find it hard praising the movie because it's not good in a classic critical sense. It's cheesy and ridiculous and silly, but the big thing is that everyone in the movie really commits to it. Yeah. There's nothing is meta. There's no haha, we're making a bad movie type of attitude to it. You know, it's played completely straight, as in, you know, everyone's here to just make a hardcore sci-fi action movie, and the result is just cheesy ridiculousness, and somehow that makes it entertaining. So.
Well, it's like comedy, right? The more you take it seriously, the funnier it gets.
Right, yeah.
All right. Well, I haven't written anything as of yet, but I do have sitting in front of me Clue on Blu-ray, which has got to be
sweet.
One of my favorite movies of the 80s. I'm also a huge fan of Neil Simon's Murder by Death, and the two of them play very well together. I often pull them out at Halloween time and watch them both. So, no bonus features on this, except for the three endings that's, you know, were in the theater and were on the DVD release. So this is just a straight dump onto Blu-ray, but I'm curious to see how well it looks. All right. Mac, why don't you shepherd us into the next section?
Sure. We're going to take a look at what's coming out next week on DVD and Blu-ray. We're going to go to DVDverdict.com, click on the upcoming DVD releases tab, and from there we'll scroll down and hit the link for the cover art gallery for July 31st. I'm just going to talk about what's on the list here.
It's Marvel Anime. This is their Wave 2. This is Blade and Wolverine.
Right. Man, Wolverine's claws are just huge in that picture. How are those claws supposed to be coming out of his knuckles? I don't know.
And so wide, so far apart.
Maybe he's holding them really close to the camera in a close perspective or something.
That's it.
We've got Detention is on there, and I believe this is the week. Oh, yeah, Mystery Science Theater. The new Mystery Science Theater set hits.
I got to get caught up on those.
Well, Eric will be happy to know that we, Trace Ballou sent over the most recent Cinematic Titanic Live.
Nice.
DVD, so.
Rattlers.
I guess the big Hollywood release would have to be Hatfields versus McCoys, which is, I believe, a miniseries.
Yeah, that was done for basic cable, right? For History Channel?
And it's gotten a lot of praise, and award nominations and whatnot. And Kevin Costner is in this. So.
And Bill Paxton.
Yeah. Well, if Kevin Costner must be in your movie, I guess it's best to have him be a cowboy, right? That's his thing. That's what he's best at.
I guess.
But yeah, this got a lot of praise, so I'm kind of curious about it.
So this would be Dances with Rednecks, then.
There you go.
it must be Marilyn Monroe's birthday or something, because they're releasing every Marilyn Monroe movie individually on Blu-ray in a very large set called Forever Marilyn.
And another one called the Marilyn Premiere Collection.
Oh, that must be the DVD version.
Oh.
Do they have a kind of big mega designer collector set where you have to lift up her skirt to get to the
Don't give them any ideas.
I know. That's so offensive. I can't believe I said that.
Jeez. They've really gotten away from that, thank God.
I don't know. Just today I saw a collector's version of the new E.T. Blu-ray that comes in the spaceship.
Are you serious?
Yep.
Oh, wait. And there's a Walking Dead season 2 coming up that has the ice pick on the guy's head. I know you people have been dying for this, but Miley Cyrus has her own movie out this week called LOL. And I somehow have a hard time imagining anybody actually laughing at that thing. Oh, my God, it stars Demi Moore. Wow, maybe it will be funny.
It doesn't look like a comedy. I mean, it almost seems like it's a horror. It can't be a horror movie. Sorry, Miley Cyrus called LOL, but that would be good.
Well, see, her boyfriend's doing big things. Now he's in Hunger Games, so she has to try and keep up.
That's right.
Okay, plot description. In a world connected by Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, Miley Cyrus stars as a teen girl navigating through peer pressure in high school the peer pressures of high school, romance and friendship, while dodging her protective mother, Demi Moore, in this fresh coming-of-age comedy.
why is she on a bearskin rug?
It's sexy.
Well, Demi Moore's your mom. You're living good.
Oh, my God. Hey, there's a William Shatner release. What is this? The Kent Chronicles. Must be some kind of 70s CBS miniseries or something. Like North and South.
Oh, man.
So you've also got the Total Recall, original Total Recall on Blu-ray.
Yes.
Which is all you probably need.
Yeah. It's the mind-bending edition.
Huh.
And if we haven't had enough superhero overkill, we've got the next Young Justice release. Which, this show is a real pleasant surprise. I've been enjoying it.
Is it still on?
I think so.
Okay.
Not sure. Cartoon Network's debuting a bunch of new shows, so...
Did I hear correctly that they have another Batman series in development?
In development. Let's see. They did Batman and the Outsiders, right?
Right.
And is that still going, or are they doing a new Batman?
I don't know.
I don't know either. These shows come and go so quick. It's hard to keep up with them.
Yeah. It's too bad Dave's not here, because we've got two Krav Maga releases this week.
Oh, sweet.
Krav Combat and Krav Maga Street Fighting. It's funny. They never send us those things for review. And what's this Randy Couture thing? Hijacked? Trying to be Jason Statham ahead of The Expendables 2?
No doubt.
All right. Well, a mixed bag of stuff, to say the least. But as always, DVD Verdict appreciates you guys spending some time on here. All right. Inadvertently sleazy-sounding DVD of the week. Eric.
Boy, I should have looked ahead of time. I guess I'll go with Extreme Burn.
Nice.
I don't know why.
Mac?
Short Night with the Glass Dolls.
Don't even want to know what that means.
That's you do that, and then you get the extreme burn.
Let's go with Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. For those who bleach their... No, never mind. All right, so let's head into our ambush topics, where we have absolutely zero preparation and spring these topics of conversation on each other. Mac, why don't you go first?
Okay, how about bizarre means of communication?
Didn't Dave talk about last week something that he just reviewed? It was the frequency with...
Oh, no, that was me.
Oh, that was Eric. Okay.
The caller.
Yeah.
Which I was going to use as an answer to this, because I realized I talked about it last week. So
yeah. Well, it was in Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. The kid was communicating with his grandmother, who lived in the building around the corner by walkie-talkie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Still, in 2012. Like the reach on those things. I don't even know if you can still buy walkie-talkies, can you?
Kids' walkie-talkies never work.
Right.
I don't know about the kind that cops use or anything, but the kind you buy in toy stores, never. They never
work. I'm trying to remember the name of this episode of The Twilight Zone where little Ron Howard plays a kid. His grandmother dies. They're very close, and he gets this toy telephone for his birthday, and he uses it to talk to his grandmother, who's dead. And it goes to some really disturbing places. His grandmother actually, from beyond the grave, convinces him to throw himself in the pool to drown himself so they can be together.
Oh my God.
The Twilight Zone. The old Twilight Zone, not even like the 80s one. Creepy.
It was a dark period for Rod Serling.
Yeah.
Well, for mine, another thing I'm working on for the site is this show from the Sci-Fi Channel called Alphas.
Oh, yeah.
And one episode has a young lady who has invented her own language. She takes her brush or her comb, and she, like, flicks it with her thumb. And then she does this in front of her laptop, and the laptop can, like, translate her made-up language.
What?
That she's come up with by just, you know, flicking the bristles on her brush.
Okay, she needs to work for the CIA.
Exactly. Well, that's the plot, is she's...
Oh.
There's a code, and only she can crack the code.
Jeez.
So,
wow.
Yeah. And it does it so, like, simultaneously, too. She just picks up the brush and, like, flicks it a little bit, and then the computer with its little robot voice automatically says, you know, good morning, how are you? It's like, oh, this is really... Yeah, more complex than it looks.
Wow. All right, Eric, what do you got?
All right, somewhat inspired perhaps by a certain movie we all watched, lesser third films in a series of movies.
Well, Star Trek, The Search for Spock, Star Trek 3, although is Star Trek on the banned list?
No, it's not. Okay. That was actually the one I was going to talk about.
It is for me, yeah. I sacrificed Star Trek.
Oh, got it. So. Well, go ahead, Eric.
Since we talked so much Batman at the beginning, I didn't get to talk about how this week I rewatched Star Trek 2, 3, and 4.
Oh, wow.
Together, because I know it's part of a trilogy. And 2 and 4 I've seen a million times. I watched it all the time when I was a kid. And I think I've only seen Star Trek 3 once. And I watched it again, and I realized why I probably only saw it once. Because it is two is amazing. I think, and that's an example of a blockbuster that is very kind of limited in scope. Things that at the beginning pay off at the end. It's very kind of tightly constructed. I think a lot of modern summer movies could learn a thing or two from that script. But and then 4, you know, I expected not to really dig 4 as much as I did when I was a kid, because I figured it was going to be dated, and you know, some of the whale infomercial stuff is, but man, that's a funny movie. That's a good movie. Like,
yes,
they're like,
yeah.
And they handle the time travel stuff well. I mean, you know, they do it in a very kind of fun way, and a lot of the humor just comes from the characters. And I loved it more than I thought I was going to. But 3 is just a mess. I'd say Christopher Lloyd, great in so many movies, but not as a Klingon.
No.
Especially when he's basically playing the part that Ricardo Montalban played in 2, just one movie later. It basically seems like it's pretty much the same movie. Just
it's 2.5. Worse. You know, there were ideas that they didn't fit into 2. You know, like putting, you know, Spock's essence into McCoy. I mean, there were just plot points that they couldn't fit in, and they decided to try. Harv Bennett said, "Hey, let's make another movie out of this." And
yeah, and I mean, and like the very beginning of the movie and the very end add something to the story.
Agreed.
But all that middle stuff is just kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, this was Nimoy's first movie, I believe. And
directing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, directing. And allegedly the studio was just like hovering over his shoulder like the whole time. So there's a lot of tension behind the scenes in that movie.
Yeah. And I love Star Trek so much in general that I can't hold it too much against, you know, the series that it's a lesser movie, but it just sandwiched in between two great movies. It definitely stands out.
Yeah.
Although now I feel like I have to come up with another one. So Mac, why don't you do yours? And I'll...
No, that's fine. I guess the first one that came to mind was Blade 3 or Blade Trinity, as it was called.
You don't have to admit, I've never seen any of the Blade films.
Oh, really?
Yep.
The first one's pretty good. The second one really rocks. Guillermo del Toro, he really brings it. And Wesley Snipes really kind of wakes up in the second movie and shows a lot of personality instead of just being Mr. Stoic tough guy. But then it all falls to pieces in the third one, with just this ridiculous plot. They bring in Dracula, but he's not really Dracula. He's the vampire that Dracula was based on. So they can call him Dracula, but he's just this other guy. And it's just a mess. There's a precocious little girl added to the cast for no reason.
Jeez.
It's like in Blade 2, they go through all this trouble to bring back Blade's mentor. That's like a major part of the story. And then in Blade 3, they just off him again, like half-heartedly. And it's just like, oh, after we went through all that to rescue the guy, now we're just going to kill him off in the third movie for why? I don't know why. It's just a mess. And, you know, it's not as, like, the first two movies are really, like, filmed very well, especially Del Toro's. And the third one, it's just bland. And bland isn't what you want in a movie about a guy who kills vampires.
I mean, there are a lot of, you know, but I think the third movie in a series is usually where it stops being good, or it's just less good than what came before. I mean, I'm having trouble thinking of a third movie in a series that is as good as or better than what came before.
Mission Impossible?
Yeah, that was J.J. Abrams who did the third one, right?
Right.
Yeah, I guess that's a good one. I mean, like, even good third movies like Back to the Future 3 or Return of the Jedi are not as good as the ones that came before it.
Well, no, if you want to, you can call this loosely being a trilogy, but Kevin Smith's first three films, which have characters that tie them all together,
mm-hmm.
Chasing Amy is the third film, which is much better than Mallrats, which is the second film.
That's true.
But that's kind of a loose definition of a trilogy.
Yeah.
I mean,
they're three very different films in their own way. So.
Right.
I don't know. Obviously, you have like Superman 3, which is as bad as I don't know if it's as bad as Star Trek 3. Meaning, I think Superman 3 is worse than Star Trek 3. But, yeah, I don't know. You get a lot. Even like Last Crusade is probably.
Last Crusade still has a special place in my heart.
And that's fine. Like, again, it's not like the third movie is always terrible. And I think that's true of this, Dark Knight Rises. It's
right.
Not terrible. It's just not as good as the other two.
Unless you're talking about Austin Powers, and Goldmember was a terrible movie.
There you go. There are also terrible second movies and first movies.
True. Very, very true.
There are no hard and fast rules here on the Friday Cool Bus.
Right. All right. So if we're also going to kind of stick with the Dark Knight theme, Christian Bale was not exactly the first choice at being an action hero, and neither was Michael Keaton. Let's look at most unlikely action heroes.
In a movie that exists?
In a movie that exists.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Shouldn't be.
The obvious one for me that came to mind was Bruce Willis in Die Hard.
Oh, that's right.
Because
he was known only for comedy.
Yeah, it was Moonlighting. You know, it was his big thing, and for the studio to kind of take a leap and give it to him, well, it paid off in spades, so.
Yeah, because the original trailer for Die Hard, he wasn't in the trailer.
Really?
Yeah, it was just like, you know, terrorists are taking over a building and only one man can stop them, Die Hard.
There
was no mention of Bruce Willis's face, nothing.
It's fine. I mean, I think that Bruce Willis is now obviously iconic as an action hero. And I think that would also be true of Liam Neeson, who probably would have seemed like the most unlikely action hero ever until he started doing those movies. So he is my choice.
So for that matter, I guess I could say Nicolas Cage.
You can very much say that.
This is true.
He says, things he says in interviews you kind of have to take with a grain of salt because he's Nicolas Cage and all, but he says he wanted to do the action hero thing because people always telling him, oh, no, you could never be an action hero. And so he was trying to prove himself.
Well, and I guess the same could be true for Johnny Depp, who was always trying to prove himself by doing different things. Although Nick of Time wasn't exactly the most auspicious start to an action hero. All right, and I'll throw out one more at you. Cary Grant in North by Northwest.
Oh,
that's a good choice.
Playing against type. Very much so. All right. So, We're going to delve into some heavy-duty spoilers here on The Dark Knight Rises, so if you have not seen it, you feel free to tune out and then tune back in after you have. But
yeah, and also, Dave did say that they're going to be, he and Dan are going to be recording a special Objection Dark Knight Rises edition, so
that is true.
If you want to skip us and go right to them, you can do that too.
And Patrick and Mike also have an F This Movie version of The Dark Knight Rises that'll be up this week as well, so you're going to be overloaded on Dark Knight talk.
I think we almost have as much audio for The Dark Knight Rises as there is movie.
There it is. We've got a commentary. We can piece together our own commentary.
We might have to like repeat it twice because the movie's so long. But
that's,
I think,
true. All right. So we started talking about things, or I should say we ended our discussion talking about things we like. What were the things that really bothered you about this film, Eric?
The thing about the movie that really bothers me is that it feels more like your average summer blockbuster than it does a Christopher Nolan movie. And I mean that it trades in a lot of cliches. There are major shortcuts taken. There are characters that are underdeveloped or introduced only so that they can be, a plot point later on. And I know that, Christopher Nolan is not exactly a character filmmaker as much as he is a complex plot creator, but it just seems like for someone who puts that much work generally into making sure all the pieces fit together, just the way time jumps around is very distracting in the movie. A lot of people have commented about how, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that this movie starts 8 years after the last one, and what is Batman doing all that time?
That kind of bugged me too, because it was almost a throwaway to say, well, but there's nothing to back it up. Like you said, there was no purpose. There's no reason to set it 8 years later.
No, I mean, Dark Knight ends with him running from the police because he's taken on this mantle.
Right.
And then basically he just runs away, and then that's it. And then there's a law that they passed that suddenly gets rid of crime. So apparently this Harvey Dent Act is more effective than Batman ever was, which doesn't make any sense.
But is that the only conceit that you need to make it 8 years later? Because there's nothing else in the film that demands that amount of time.
And in fact,
you get the sense that time has passed. So do you really need to specify?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they need that 8 years so that they can just kind of tell us that 3 years prior to the beginning of the movie, Bruce Wayne set up this, clean energy initiative with Miranda Tate, which is again sort of a throwaway thing, and it becomes such a big deal. I mean, that's like that relationship to me is just completely underdeveloped, and they sort of just try to jam it in so they can have this twist at the end that kind of doesn't work either. And again, it's just sort of another bit of fan service, and there's so much fan service kind of just crammed into this movie that it's at the sacrifice of the plot and the story.
Well, boy, did that piss me off, because when they started to do Bane's origin story and they said he was the son of Ra's al Ghul, I got so pissed off. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. And then, of course, the reveal with Talia at the end, which in my experience with Batman throughout the books and the animated series, I love the relationship between Talia and Ra's and Bruce, because it was this always this sense of respect, this push and pull, this kind of cat and mouse thing all the time. So I love the fact that Liam Neeson came back and had that conversation. And to my mind, he really was there. It wasn't a figment of Bruce's imagination, but he did show up and have that conversation, because we know the Lazarus Pit, and I'm sure that's where Talia will wind up at the end of this film. But, just getting there, like you said, it took a long time to get there. And then to kind of shortchange that relationship, I think, did it a disservice.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a twist just to have a twist and just to have Talia al Ghul in the movie. It doesn't serve any purpose. I mean, on Patrick and Mike's podcast, they talk about how that moment really undermines the Bane character, and that's true. I mean, that you had this strong leader who's all of a sudden defanged at the last minute because he's just doing the bidding of someone else.
I don't know if I would necessarily agree that he's defanged, but it does put him in a very subservient role.
Sure, sure. And when that happened in the movie, it seemed to me that it was a good way to humanize him, although I can certainly see the point.
Yeah. And they got rid of the whole Venom thing, Mac. The fact that he has to survive on this juice to keep him going, it just became a breathing apparatus.
Yeah, they kind of hinted at it with the mask has little doohickeys on it that are his painkillers.
Yeah.
So it's kind of there, but they put their own spin on it. So, yeah, I didn't mind that so much. I think Eric really nailed it when he mentioned shortcuts. They are trying to do so much in this movie, and they've got so many different plot lines, and they've got this entire checklist of stuff they want to do and want to get on screen that they're doing a lot of shortcuts. They, the filmmakers, are doing a lot of shortcuts to get put all this plot together. And I think that's where the movie is, you know, at its shakiest.
And it just seems to take an inordinate amount of time to get there. Like the fact that they were tracking the nuclear device for so long.
Right.
Yeah, at the same time, they start with, like, it's been 5 months. You have 5 months, and then all of a sudden it's, oh, we have 18 hours left.
Right.
Like, there's all these crazy time jumps. I mean, even the fact that they have this nuclear device that exists only to be a nuclear device to blow up at the end of the movie.
Right.
I mean, it serves no other story purpose except to be a countdown clock and a thing that Batman has to carry out over the water and not die when it explodes. So again, it's that kind of stuff. It's just like they're movie cliches that don't belong in a supposedly grounded universe. It feels like a standard summer blockbuster, a very well made, better than average standard summer blockbuster. But there's nothing really special about what he's done other than to throw a lot of stuff together in a thrilling way. But when you put all the thrilling scenes together, they don't add up to be, you know, to really satisfy a movie.
Do you think he didn't have time or interest in making
a script? I just heard this recently on film. Whoever is the real film critic, Culp, was on a Nerdist podcast recently and said that what he had heard from people he knows is that after Heath Ledger's death, and I guess Nolan was going to base the third movie kind of very heavily around the Joker, and then when Heath Ledger died, it kind of took a lot out of him personally, and he lost a lot of interest. And Warner Brothers basically then offered him all the money in the world and said, "You can make whatever movie you want. We'll fund it. It's fine, but you have to come back after it and do a third Batman movie." And that's how we got Inception. And so he may really have just kind of lost interest in it and kind of created this movie to sort of please the fans in the sense that let's just give them everything that they want, you know. So instead of having a really compelling, narratively rich story, it becomes this kitchen sink approach to Batman filmmaking. I mean,
the movie, though, it's very ambitious, though. I mean,
sure.
With Dark Knight, they set the bar really high for themselves, and they reached it. You know, they were really ambitious, and it paid off in a big way. And now, I think with this movie, they're trying to go even farther.
And it's not that it's lazy. It's just that it's not cohesive. It's just it's overstuffed. It doesn't, you know, it just doesn't all work together. I mean, there are amazing action scenes, and the whole, you know, the explosion in the football stadium and the bridges all falling. I mean, there's some great set pieces in the movie, and like I said, those scenes are just, I mean, I'm sure that's what Christopher Nolan wanted to do, is do those scenes, but yeah, I don't know.
Did it bother either one of you guys that Gotham looked so different, or that there were little things like Wayne Manor? Maybe it took 8 years for them to rebuild Wayne Manor, I don't know.
Right.
But there just seemed to be some disconnects that were just kind of like, pay no attention to these and just...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, things like Gotham and Wayne Manor, they look different in every movie.
Right.
So you kind of have to go with that. Although his big sort of underground bunker place from Dark Knight, that made a return in this movie. So I was like, oh, I remember this set.
Right. But,
One of the things that sort of feels disconnected about the movie is that it has very little to do with Dark Knight and has a lot more to do with Batman Begins.
That's true.
It's very much a continuation of the first movie, and except for, you know, the exception of the truth about Harvey Dent and that whole kind of convoluted bit about Gordon writing it all down on a piece of paper for Bane to find and reveal later on.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's kind of it. Like, it's like Rachel dies and Harvey Dent was actually evil. And like those two things factor sort of into the plot here, but really just as a way to pay homage to Dark Knight. It doesn't really factor into the actual story.
Would they have done better, or would he done? Well, this is all speculation, but would he have done better if he had chosen a different villain than Bane?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe if he had only chosen Bane. I mean, I think the problem is that there are just too many villains. I mean, it's the same problem with a lot of the later Batman movies, and even Batman Returns. I remember it's been a long time since I've seen that movie, but it felt like splitting the difference between two villains didn't help that movie.
Yeah, I don't know, because that's a tough question to answer, because I think with different dialogue, you could take that sort of same evil scheme and you could attribute it to the Joker or the Riddler. You know, I've got an evil plan. I'm going to, you know, take down Gotham City. I'm going to run it. I'm going to cut it off from the rest of the U.S. and it's going to be my own personal kingdom. You know, you can see a lot of different characters sort of doing that same plot, but for their own reasons, putting their own spins on it.
Right. And that was funny, because when Joseph Gordon-Levitt was first cast, the speculation was that he was going to be the Riddler.
Right. I remember reading that.
Yeah. And then to have him turn out to be Robin at the end was just a complete difference from what...
I kept wondering throughout the whole movie, are they going to go there? Are they going to go there? Are they going to go there?
And, yeah.
But then the last minute of the movie, oh, they went there.
And I liked his character a lot. I thought, without explicitly saying he's Robin until the end, they did a really good job of creating that dynamic between Batman and this other capable, younger orphan guy who for some reason knows he's Batman. That was unclear to me.
Here's another thing that really bugged me, and not to interrupt you, but how many people in this movie know Bruce Wayne is Batman?
Everyone. It's like this latest Spider-Man movie where everyone, you know, it takes his mask off for anyone.
It's like the Kim Basinger moment in the original Tim Burton one. It's like, do you really want to let all these people know who you are? I mean, it kind of defeats the purpose, dude.
And there's a lot of this stuff is kind of nitpicky, but they never make it clear in this movie how all these people know Bruce Wayne's Batman.
Right.
I saw it in your eyes is not exactly – it's not really a good reason.
You made a mistake on your Facebook page.
Exactly.
You slipped up.
Well, they sure can't say they recognize the voice.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. There are a lot of little things. I wish the movie had done more with sort of some of the political ideas that it pays lip service to but never does much with. I mean, Bane starts out with this kind of whole, you know, taking down the rich idea, and then he just wants to blow everyone up, so it doesn't make any sense. I mean, there's a lot of things that are just like a lot of, again, the kitchen sink approach. And I, again, when I rewatch this, which I inevitably will do, I don't know if I'll see it in the theater, but I'll definitely own the Blu-ray at some point. I may, you know, a lot of this stuff may just be forgivable, and I'll just get sucked in by the action and just have fun with it. And, you know, Christopher Nolan does what he does very well. And compared to 98% of summer movies that have ever come out, this is pretty good.
Right.
Most summer movies are terrible, but this is not terrible.
Well, I'm sure Warner Brothers will release a trilogy box set. Mm-hmm. With the hope that they will include the bonus materials that have been lacking up to this point.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how many bonus features there'll be. Isn't Christopher Nolan kind of notoriously not interested in talking about?
That you are correct, but I'm curious to see, given just the size of this franchise, how much leverage they're going to have in sitting him down to make him do this.
He did a commentary for Memento. It was really good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I'm sad to say I have not seen that movie.
Really? Oh, man.
I know. It's one of my embarrassment film critics.
It's a really good movie, yeah. Guy Pearce is way better in Memento than he is in Lockout.
You heard it here first on Friday Filibuster. Mac taking a contrarian position.
Well, and on that bombshell, I think we'll wrap it up for this week. But thank you guys for tuning in. Dave will be back next week. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Mac. And until then, Mac, take it away.
I'm Batman.